It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. Well, we're back to the funky lead-in today, huh?
Come on, it's feeling funky in here.
And we've even got a guest in the studio.
Sheba.
Sheba, though.
Hey, Sheba.
Black Lab just decided to come up and join us.
She's doing her one-ear trick.
She's got that down, doesn't she?
That is cool looking.
She looks like she's always signaling for a left turn.
She's got one ear up and the other ear down.
Hey, she's
and it's looking very funny.
She's on the website. People can have a look at her if she wants to.
There you go. It's hidden. You got to find it.
Actually, we're staying on from the previous broadcast and just kind of, we got talking a little bit about some of the world events things that are going on. We got started with the Danish cartoons. That's caused quite a bit of stir.
A little bit of a stir going on about that, huh?
And having Danish background myself, since that's where the Jacobson surname comes from.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, I'm traveling on an American passport these days with a Danish surname. I could be in trouble.
Ooh, very nice. Yeah.
My plane gets hijacked.
Don't start doodling anywhere.
They're going to pull me right out of that line.
You're in trouble.
But boy, a few cartoons have created a whole new societal angst. These cartoons are relatively old. They're from last fall. But I guess they're finally hitting the Islamic world and they're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, they're a little upset.
So what do you think about all that?
You know what? I think there's a lot going on under the surface that it would be a real mistake to just sort of gloss over and make fun of. You have our article by this rabbi guy that is just fantastic.
Well, someone sent me this link this morning. Most of you know Rabbi Mark Gelman. He's a commentator for Newsweek magazine. In fact, the current issue out has one of his columns, Can't We All Just Get Along? And he kind of begins to probe some things that we want to talk about probably in the course of getting through this issue today. I've been concerned, quite honestly, before we kind of respond to some of what he's written here. Kind of the almost knee jerk reaction you hear from some Christians about this. You know, they're cartoons, and now they're all upset. How come they weren't upset when they blew up buildings, or even when they blow up a mosque with people, their own people who've died in Iraq? That's happened numerous times. Why aren't these people upset then? They're all upset over a little cartoon.
Well, I think it tells us that there's a whole lot that we don't really understand from our context. I mean, when you look at the world and how different folks, it'd be easy to just sort of wipe this away like, oh, crazy Islamists. But I think there's a whole lot more going on there.
Well, there's got to be. I mean, our culture is pretty much, Western culture is pretty much used to the fact that everything gets made of in cartoons. Everything gets made fun of. I mean, Christians are made fun of. God's made fun of. I mean, we're used to a culture in which that happens, but that culture is not.
Yeah, and every authority structure is ridiculed. And
absolutely. Cartoonists, maybe they're the ones that ought to be taken to a prison somewhere off Cuba's coast or something.
So what do you think is going on?
Well, we're pointing out again the differences of the religious faiths and how we deal with it. Gelman's gets to that. I guess I was concerned because I haven't heard talk of there's a website now that's going to sell T-shirts with this cartoon on them. You notice most American media outlets I've not seen the cartoons. You hear about them, but no one's wanting to inflame that community by actually running them. Well, now some entrepreneur has decided he'll make shirts with this cartoon on them. And last I heard, somebody tried to go there, and the website is just crashing because it's got way too many people ordering. And I'm kind of interested in that being our response to this. I mean, we're kind of in a culture now that says, hey, that offends me. Well, great. I'll put it on a T-shirt, and I'll offend you really good. I mean, I don't get that, really.
It's not really building a bridge, is it?
Yeah. Well, that's a nice segue into bridge building, but that's not really why we're here. So I wonder how, I mean, obviously this podcast is not going to change the dialogue, but I hope maybe us talking about this will find a way that we can help communicate with people who see the world differently than we do. And I guess that's what we're not good at right now.
Yeah, well, the church historically tends to have this posture of us versus them. It's sort of like even their approach to truth that so oftentimes is, you know, by well-intentioned, sincere Christians, it's like they'll slice and dice a person if they can find that something that they've said is wrong, right, as opposed to trying to understand where might this person be coming from. You know, I look at the generosity with which Jesus dealt with people who were wrong. The only group that he ever seemed to really take a whip to, so to speak, was the religious community that was so sure they were so right. And virtually everyone else, Jesus really met them where they were at and tried to draw them to a different place. And that isn't what I think on the culture of the church, that isn't what, you know, on the whole, the Christian community has picked up.
It hasn't been. You remember back not too many years to the art exhibit where a crucifix was put in human urine and things like that that were belittling Christianity. And Christians then weren't saying, hey, it's just art, who cares? There was an outcry of why do we think it's art to deface the symbols that mean something to people? And now it seems like some of the Christian communities on the other side of that. Well, it's okay to deface your religious symbols, just don't deface mine. And maybe we've gotten too used to it, too jaded. I like what the first bit of Mark Gelman, and we'll put a link to this on the blog so that you can find the full commentary if you want to. But he's asking the question from this erupting, or do they have a right to, you know, free speech, all the arguments we could make. And he asked some different questions. You know, what are we going to learn from this? Not necessarily what should we do about it, what we mean. And the first point he makes is core beliefs are not funny. Religion, like race and ethnic identity, are core beliefs. And, you know, racial jokes are kind of out of favor these days and should be. Religious humor isn't, however. People poke fun all the time. And in this case, you've got one cartoonist in Denmark does a deal in kind of a tabloidish type paper. And I'm telling you, people are paying for it. All about 19 dead in the Middle East over it now, and embassies being burned down. I mean, one cartoonist makes an expression of something, and I guess it was the Prophet Muhammad with a turban that looked like a bomb, a fuse or something, trying to depict how people are perceiving particularly radical Islam in the world today. And it's not that you can understand why that image would evoke some response, not only in the West, saying, yeah, that's how we're seeing Islam now. I mean, the warfare...
That's not completely out of context in light of what's been happening in the world.
No, for people
for
blowing
some satirist them. To you know, doodle that. You're just going like...
Right, and people blowing up things and citing their allegiance to Allah in doing it. So, yeah, you can understand why that's not a totally unfair way to present it. At the same time, you can perhaps understand why a culture that doesn't even allow images of the Prophet Muhammad to be drawn or in art at all would react to that kind of thing. And then how would the West respond to that? I mean, we do something fairly insensitive. It evokes a huge response. And now the West takes the defense of, well, to apologize or to somehow deal with that would be to capitulate to terrorism. Or it would be to give up our free speech rights, which are sacrosanct in the West. What do we do about it?
Well, you know, I think if we're going to get anywhere in our culture and in advancing the kingdom, I think we've got to find some. What I like so much about that Rabbi Mark Gelman is he didn't say, you know, he said we're sort of taught in the U.S. that, you know, you grow up and you ask, well, what does this mean? He said, but in the context of his Jewish upbringing, that is not the question they ask, is what does this mean? Is they ask first, what can we learn from this? And I got to tell you, that was stunning to me because it's like, you know, if you look at what's going on, as opposed to, well, what does it mean that they're doing this? It's like, no, I need to learn something because this does look like insanity to me.
Yeah.
I mean, bottom line, it seems insane.
Absolutely.
It seems an inappropriate response. But if I wanted to ask, what can I learn? It tells me there is something fomenting deep under the surface that if we fail to understand, you know, we may, you know, sow to the wind and reap the whirlwind here.
Yeah, he compares it to like a joke about blacks, a racial joke being made by whites. And he's saying that's pretty much what this is. It is just not funny or in good taste or even in bad taste. It is just wrong for anyone to insult other people's core identity and then hide behind freedom of the press. Yes, we in the West have the right to say any stupid thing we want. But when people get really pissed off about it, there's your word, we can't hide or blame them because they can't take a joke. Making fun of Muhammad is just a stupid, insensitive thing to do, even if you have the right to do it. Showing a cross in a glass of urine is a stupid, insensitive thing to do, even if you have the right to do it. Defending one's right to do or say something stupid and offensive as if that ends the conversation is more than naive. It just misses the point of respecting what people are at the core of their being. That's why Polish jokes and gay jokes and black jokes are wrong. They're not wrong because they're not funny. Many of them are hilarious. They are wrong because they are not told by the better angels of our nature.
And I think they're hardly ever innocent. At the bottom core, I don't know that the guy that wrote the cartoon, I don't know his motives.
Right, of course not.
But I'll guarantee that there was a design behind it. Even in passing on some jokes that we think are so funny, there is an element that when you know it can be ridiculing or hurtful to somebody else, your choice to tell it isn't innocent.
Well, it may or may not be, but certainly when you start pressing the T-shirts, now, obviously there's an agenda there. And when I hear Christians talk about this, there is kind of a, yeah, back to your face. I mean, what are we doing to speak peace into the conflict instead of fan the flames of the conflict? I think one of my issues early on with the Bush administration, we're talking about dead and alive, and if you're not with us, you're for us, and all that rhetoric that fanned our country into some kind of thing was also fanning the terrorists to continue their stuff with more. I mean, you can't blame Bush for what they're doing, and I'm not even suggesting that, so go easy on me on the forum, please. But what I am saying is a soft answer turns the way wrath is, as Paul spoke about it. What are we doing as a nation? What are we doing as Christians to speak into the amount of cultural angst that exists in the world and the stereotypes of other cultures and people and fomenting the conflict, getting angrier about things instead of somehow looking to be redemptive and diffuse the anger?
Well, you think of, you know, religion and politics are almost always fuses to blow up some kind of conversation. And when you look at the sort of stark cultural divide that is even in our own country, you don't even have to make this between Christianity and Islam and put a global scope to it. You just look at Republicans and Democrats and the heat and the anger that can be expressed there that, you know, I end up looking at so many of the arguments and so many of the almost blind reactions to stuff. I mean, you think of just, you know, the Cheney shooting a lawyer and just how that's being, I mean, to some degree, it's terribly funny. To another degree, it's terribly opportunistic.
There's
to try
all
to
kinds
make
of lawyer jokes
issue
there,
about
but
it.
There's all kinds of lawyer jokes there, but we're not lawyers, so we can't do
tell
it.
Tell them. Don't tell them.
Yeah, we're not.
But you just look at how a moment like that gets blown up into something far, it's like, what does that accident have to do with religious politics? It has nothing to do with, but look at how much is made of it. And you're just going like, what's going on here? And how are Christians? How are Christians being salt and light? You know, what is our responsibility as just an average citizen? Do I ignore it? Do I say, oh, you know, just do I make fun of it? Or perhaps do I salt the conversations that are around me with a fresh, new, different perspective that seeks to diffuse some of the polarity? Or do I just join in and help it polarize?
Because as Gelman points out in his column, it's easy to point the finger. It's easy to point to the hypocrisy of Islam if it'll blow up the Buddha statues in Afghanistan and then demand that their icon be respected in Denmark. I mean, to say that isn't hypocrisy is to be naive. It is hypocrisy, absolutely. But as he points out, it is easier to see others' hypocrisy than it is our own. It's easy at times when other people are messing up to point at other people and deal with them in that way.
You know, I thought he had a great line at the very end. He says, you know, we're not like the rioters. You know, it's like you guys are like, oh my gosh, what an incredible, ridiculous,
we're way beyond that,
response.
Yeah.
He says, but we're also not as different from them as we may think in our self-righteous fog. And it's like, man, I felt the sting of reality in that, because you just go like, you know what? Do we understand much about the Middle Eastern culture and the way things are perceived and understood? Do we have any sense of why they look upon America as the great Satan? And I want to say, you know, if you had an understanding of some of their cultural context, it does make sense why they, when they look at what gets just polluted from our country. Now, am I polluting? Am I actively doing? I don't believe I am. I'm trying to do something about that, actually. But the reality is
driving your SUV around, you mean?
Yes, I am supporting terrorists. I am paying for
their
gas.
3 gallon a mile. Something like that.
Just wait till I buy my Hummer. But the reality,
they'll be coming over here with that Hummer.
Stop that.
Okay.
But the reality is you know, I think when we look at what's going on, we don't do much to understand why perhaps we're perceived the way they are. And I don't justify anything, but I also don't want to justify our self-righteousness.
Absolutely. And how do we help? Is there any way we could be helpful in lowering the rhetoric? I think Gelman, he pointed out in another section of the column, that the angst we're seeing in the riots and the burning thing isn't really about a cartoon. It's by a group of people who've been, as he says, left in the 8th century while they watch the rest of the world enjoy their iPods and plasma TVs and all those kinds of things. And there is, I mean, they are an oppressed group of people by their own government and by their own religious leaders. But they've put all that angst on the U.S. But it doesn't do any good for us to respond to that conflict with the same kind of
and
conflict.
Play into it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it just feeds it. And somehow we've got to be a voice that speaks for peace, that speaks for, hey, we can, and I know I've had this go on with Christian groups since I've been doing, many of you know, maybe you don't, those on the podcast here, I've done a thing called Bridge Builders for the last 14 years or so, helping public school districts deal with church-state conflicts. And I run into this all the time. You know, people enjoy the conflict. And whether it's secularists against Christians, whether it's gay rights advocates against you know, religious conservatives, there's almost a desire, and now we see it with the evolution and intelligent design thing. That whole controversy, I think, is so easy to fix. And people who are in the know on that know there's a very easy way to get to a solution here that would please both the scientists and the advocacy group for Christians that are feeling like they're getting a bad shake in science. And I don't mean just a straight compromise. We'll give half the time to evolution and half the time to intelligent design, because that's not science's answer. But there's still a way to do it. But I've even talked to one of the largest foundations recently who deal with science and religion in education, and they're just going, we're not doing anything to bring peace there. We're not even interested. So we'll just litigate to death, and school districts will get this thrown out. And anytime you bring up, hey, let's respect people who disagree with us, Christians, I get really tired of this, cry that relativism thing. You're just saying everybody gets to define their own truth. And I'm saying, what is it about coexisting with each other and respecting your right to differ? What's wrong with that? Instead of, no, I can't. If I disagree with you, I have to kill you. Now, that's what are you laughing about? 400 years ago, that's exactly
I know
what religionists were doing.
That is the absurdity of kind of what we sometimes do in the name of God.
Exactly.
Like somehow I must defend God. Like he's in danger if I don't kill you.
He's really in trouble when people start making fun of him because he's not big enough to deal with it himself. That's exactly right. But we've got this idea that somehow I have the, and we don't get to kill each other with guns and stones anymore, unless you're the vice president. We don't get to actually use those weapons anymore, but you know what? We do it verbally. And I had one guy tell me, I think every public school in America ought to be able to vote exactly the kind of religion they want to teach in a public school classroom. And if anybody doesn't like it, they can just move out of that district. Well, he's in Oklahoma. He's going to be a little safer doing it than out here in California. You're no telling what's going to win. But the idea that we can't share the forum, that we can't coexist in the world, that Christianity is not, and I hate saying the word Christianity anymore. I just say it and I go, ugh, that just sounds like religion. The life of Christ can function in a world without having to dominate the political landscape. In fact, it does better when it's been a counterculture than ever when it's been the majority dominant culture.
You know, what's so interesting is, you know, this is a little bit of a different discussion, but why do you think we have to polarize things? And, you know, when I can't know the motives of someone's heart, why are we so quick when someone disagrees for me to attach the label evil on that?
Or not, yeah, evil or wicked, or even a lot of times you're saying you're only doing that for your own self-interest or your own gain or your own whatever. We're just nuts about assigning motives because you have to vilify. Again, if I get to kill what disagrees with me, and I can't do it with guns and rocks, so I've got to do it with their person, vilifying anyone who disagrees with us or even anyone who sees it a shade differently than we do, that is an accepted tactic in Western dialogue and debate.
Well, you look at our whole political culture, and it's like it's no longer about the rightness and wrongness of ideas. I mean, we seem to be a government of total self-interest, and if you have enough money, you can buy your – I mean, you know, they can try to –
don't get me started there.
but when you look at this, it's like, you know, where's the true exchange of ideas where – the value of what is being said or what needs to be done is given the chance to stand up to the scrutiny, as opposed to, well, let's just vilify everyone around so that way I can throw so much mud up on that wall that ultimately the idea gets disfigured and all I see is mud up there, so it'll fall down. And it's like, we're never going to go forward as a country, as a culture, as a society, unless we find a way to allow healthy, genuine debate of different ideas to resurface again.
Yeah, but that just makes lousy television, lousy
books. The radio
won't
go anywhere if you just make everyone play nice.
I had a book we were shopping to major publishers a few years back on this bridge builder theme. It was called When Worldviews Collide, and it was about, you know, finding the dialogue. Just the dialogue you described, that in the national discussion of abortion and homosexuality in places where we hold deep and profound differences. Every publisher we talked to, and I had some major agents in New York City, not Christian agents, secular agents representing this book to secular publishers. We also did it to Christian publishers, and they had the same answer that the secularists did. They said, you know what? We cannot sell a book on peacemaking. I said, what? See, look at all the cultural affairs books that are out there. You've got to choose somebody on the other side of this debate. The Coulters, the O'Reillys, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys. These people choose a side in the debate and absolutely vilify the other side. Exaggerate their arguments, mock them teasingly. Those books sell. And the left does the same thing. Franken does it with his, and other groups do it as well. And the point that they were saying is books that talk about, hey, how to have a reasonable discussion, no one will walk into Barnes & Noble and buy that book. It cannot be sold. And they loved the book. They were saying, we love your writing style. We love what you're acting, how to get to common ground with people who disagree with you. But in the end, they were saying, we can't sell that book. It will not sell.
And you know, maybe I'm an idiot, but the reality is I don't think that's true.
I don't know. We call a few people and ask.
At the end of the day, I don't think that's true, because I think you're coming to a place where the world is in so desperate need of some peacemaking, genuine peace, not just crying peace, but genuine ability to solve problems and bring divergent groups that want to kill each other to the table.
But even when people try, they get vilified. I'll give you an example. Someone sent me last week some comments that Bono had made, the U2 singer, and I don't know anything about rock and roll. I don't know that I've ever heard a U2 song all the way through, so I'm not...
Wait.
I'm sorry. I'm just not...
I will work on it.
I'm not a music guy, and people lambast me all over the world for it, but that's beside the point. Anyway, he was asked to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast, which I think was pretty cool, and I thought he said some wonderful things. Now, I don't agree with everything Bono says, but some of the excerpts that I put up on my blog I thought were pretty powerful things. Well, someone wrote in almost immediately, don't you know this Bono guy is a universalist? And he's out saying, you know, Jews and Muslim and Islam, or Jews, Christianity and Islam is all the same thing. And I'm going, what? And they talked about this coexist little headset he wears. I don't know if you've seen this little headband he wears in the current concert that they're doing. And it says coexist, and the C is in the shape of the Muslim crescent. The X is the Star of David, and the T is the sign of the cross. And so when you look at this, and you can, you know, put coexist in Bono on the web, and you can see the picture. Yeah, Googling, that's easy. It looks kind of sinister, particularly for those of us that are worried about, you know, one world governments and the end of the age. I mean, I can see why people would go, whoa, that's spooky. And then someone for Relevant Magazine did a quote from his concert where he said, Christian, Jew, Muhammad, it's true, and was saying, oh, he's a universalist. He's saying all these religions are the same thing. But when you actually, I saw a video of the concert. Actually, I had a friend I was staying with in St. Louis who's a big Bono fan, and we saw a bit of the concert where he's wearing the headband. He's saying that. But the end of it, what he's saying is true, is they're all children of Abraham, which is true.
Yep.
He's not saying all the religions are true. He's saying it's true that we've all come from Abraham. Why can't we find a way to coexist on this planet without killing each other? And for a man who grew up, Bono is the son of a Catholic mother and a Protestant father in Ireland back in the 50s and 60s. Now, do we not understand why coexist would be a pertinent, important message? But again, you say it. You got a guy speaking it, and you've got Christian groups, and there's whole websites out there about Bono being the Antichrist. And I mean, people have sent it. There's been this big raging thing on my blog just because I quoted some things like this, that what he said, which I thought was great. He said, for me at least, he's talking about religion. He said, one of the things I picked up from my father and my mother was the sense that religion often gets in the way of God. Now, I think
amen, brother. Preach it. I agree.
For me at least, it got in the way. Seeing what religious people in the name of God did to my native land. And in this country, seeing God's secondhand car salesman on the cable TV shows offering indulgences for cash. In fact, all over the world, seeing the self-righteousness roll down like a mighty stream from certain corners of religious establishment, I must confess, I changed the channel. And I can't blame him. My goodness. I can't blame him for saying there's a real disconnect between religion and God. We've been saying that for a year on this podcast and much longer in our own lives, I'm sure. He was challenging some wonderful things. You don't have to agree with somebody to enjoy what little bit they add to the puzzle, or they don't have to be a dyed-in-the-wool Christian. And Bono may be. I've not seen Bono ever act inconsistent with someone of faith, other than the rock and roll stuff he does, because I'm not a rock and roll fan. But his whole challenge, Newsweek magazine recognized him as a philanthropist in calling the world to care about what goes on in Africa. Here's how he ended that little bit of speech. He said, there is a continent, Africa, being consumed by flames. I truly believe that when the history books are written, our age will be remembered for three things: the war on terror, the digital revolution, and what we did or did not do to put out the fire in Africa. Now, why would you want to distort that message with all this angst of conflict? But I tell you, one blog about it, and people are all over it.
Well, it just seems so goofy that a guy who's chosen to take his celebrity status and to challenge the global political powers to end poverty in our generation. Now, that certainly sounds like Satan to me.
Sounds pretty cool.
Let's vilify that guy. He's got to be stopped. What else will he do? And he just go like, you know, there's no way that, you know, when you look at what's going on, I mean, I love the fact that there is this whole cause celeb that is now, you know, more philanthropic out there. It's like, we want to do something to help. And it's like, do I think all of those people are doing it for pure motives? No, I don't. But does it bother me? No, it doesn't. Because it's moving the whole scale away from self-centeredness to a sense of, gosh, there's more than just me as the center of my universe, and maybe I can take what I have to do something to help another life. That is awesome. I don't ever want to fight that.
And anyone in the West lives in a land of privilege.
Oh,
we do. And when you sit in those townships in South Africa, you get near kids that, I was there watching kids suffer that were the same age as my granddaughter at home. How does my granddaughter get born into all the privilege she gets born into? These kids have nothing. These lives in a world that is arrayed against them. And it's part of that angst that we see feeding into the Islamic revolution around the world. It's the angst of being an oppressed people with nothing while the rest of the world just parties. Mustard Seed Conspiracy was a book that Thomas Sein wrote back in the early 80s. I remember reading that book. The whole beginning page of it was a group of people at this party celebrating and, you know, eating and feasting and having a great time. And that's a very small percentage of all the rest of the world just looking through the glass window, not having any hope of ever participating in that. And it really, in some ways, it appealed to a lot of guilt. But again, at the end of the day, does it matter that they're appealing to guilt if it moves people away from self-centeredness? You know, I wouldn't do it because I don't think guilt in the long run, and I think that book in the long run, didn't have the impact it could have had because it was guilt-based. But is there something Scripture talks about over and over again, that when you have a heart for Jesus, you will also have a heart for the poor and the oppressed, and you'll work for justice, and you'll work for peace, and you'll work for sharing the wealth with people who don't have it. Those themes are as bedrock to the New Testament as anything else we could talk about.
Yeah, it just seems so, it's frustrating to me that so much of what I think is popularly perceived about Christianity is we get so hung up on the doctrinal rightness or wrongness of our own pet theology opinions that we are willing to kill each other because we disagree. And you're not just of a different opinion, but you're wrong and you're evil and you're a servant of Satan if you disagree with what I think. And you just go like, gosh, how is that at all consistent with Jesus Christ?
Absolutely. Someone sent me a little Pharisee test the other day, an email. I can't remember where it was or all that was there, but one of the contrasts it had for that, if you got a little bit of a Pharisaical tendency, it says truth is more important than love. And on the other side of that was people who realize love is the most important part of truth. And I thought that was a neat way to say it.
Yeah, you're not sacrificing one for the other, but truth that isn't expressed in love isn't the truth that Jesus brought.
Absolutely. The truth, love is the most important part of truth. If we're going to convey truth to the world, we've got to do it in a spirit of love. Whenever I talk about bridge builder stuff, particularly, I mean, the big angst right now is how we deal with sexual orientation discrimination in a public school. In California right now, it is a protected civil right. And Christian groups are trying to, you know, keep any policies that's going to work for anti-discrimination off the table. And so we can say to the gay community all we want to, we love the sinner but hate the sin, but it's pretty clear to them we hate them both. I mean, our words are, they're nice,
they're
in
empty.
Our club,
they're
because
empty,
they're
though.
Absolutely empty. In fact, I've just been invited to go back to D.C. early March here and be on C-SPAN, I guess, to help a brochure that I helped the First Amendment Center craft, dealing with how can we deal with sexual orientation discrimination in the public schools without undermining people of faith. And we brought religious groups together, we brought Christian groups together, as well as gay rights advocacy groups together to say, here's how we can do it. We don't have to say gay is okay to say, let's make sure no one on a public school campus is being bullied or harassed or teased or mocked. I mean, we all have a vested interest, whether it's because they're gay or not or perceived gay or not. Whether I met a woman who showed up at an event I did, Christian woman, and I knew her from before. And she showed up at an event we were doing to mediate some things having to do with gay rights in a public high school. And it was about not just gay rights, but those that are perceived to be gay. And she had this contrary opinion to the whole thing. When we got done, she came up to me afterwards. She said, you know, this is not just about gay people. She said, my son comes home every day from PE because the kids bully him because he's very slight and he's, you know, kind of slight of build. And so kids mock him as, you know, calling him the names that they call gay kids. And I said, don't you? And she was there fighting the policy. And I'm saying, you don't understand, this policy is as much for your son as it is anybody else. No one should have to come to a public school and be mocked and harassed and bullied for any reason, whether people are right or wrong about the perception. That's all this is about. But people would rather keep, no, it's about whether you accept gays or not, and we're not about to, and they ought to stay in the closet. And you know what? That ship has sailed.
Yeah, it just it seems so contrary in my understanding. When you look at how Jesus responded to the woman caught in adultery, okay? She was brought before him. Now, is adultery wrong? Uh-huh.
No problem there.
Was there a real issue that, you know, the Pharisees...
We can bring the wives back to confirmation of that.
The Pharisees are basically trying to test Jesus, and it's like, when you look at Jesus' response to the woman caught in adultery, did he ever condone what she did?
Absolutely
no.
Not.
It's absolutely wrong. But was she someone to be loved? Was she a person of value? Was she someone that was valuable enough to redeem? Absolutely. And so when you look at how does Christ apply truth and the law and reality, he applies it with what it's supposed to bring us unto, that each and every person out there is someone that Christ died for, that he absolutely loves, that is worth redeeming. Now, if in the name of truth, we pick up rocks and we just decide to stone them, that doesn't seem to be the option that was left before Jesus. He didn't choose that one.
Yeah, in fact, he was the one that could have thrown the first stone. And
yeah.
That's all he was asking for. Let he who's out sin throw first, then the rest of it can pile on. Well, if the guy who can throw first doesn't, we got no business piling on. I think we missed John 3:17. If the Son of Man did not come to the world to condemn the world, why would we? If anyone had the right to condemn the world, he did. Now, Jesus did bring a sword. Yes, our world is being divided between those who will love him and those who don't. But you know what? You don't know who those people are yet. If people have not been loved, that isn't over till the end of the age is over. There are people still that we might reject for one reason or another, that God still wants them loved. He still said, blessed are the peacemakers. The sword is there. Culture's being divided. Don't you exacerbate it. This is not the mission of Christianity to divide the culture. It's ours to I love what you said. Every person God loves is worthy of seeing from us. Someone who loves and takes an interest in them, especially if we disagree with something they believe or a lifestyle they live. Even more do we need to make that love known to them.
I mean, I know this is a bizarre thought for some folks, but it's like you take someone like Hitler, a genuine villain in the earth, you know, and if on Hitler's last breath, if he would have responded to Christ, would Jesus have rejected him? I think a lot of us have real trouble with that. We want to like...
I hear some people say, we hope so.
Yeah. I don't want him to be in it. And you just go like, you know, God is there desiring to reconcile the entire world to himself. And yet I think the way we've been brought up in a culturalized Christianity is we are more focused on who's right, who's wrong. And we sort of divvy out salvation to who we think does deserve it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't say that. But the reality is our lives live out that message because the gospel, the genuine, awesome, amazing, great news, no better news in all the world, I don't think has very effectively ever been preached so as to be heard. Because the way in which we dole it out, you know, it's like, you know, 12,000 for me, one for you. You know, it's like, you know, we want all the mercy for ourselves, but we're so minute in what we provide to others. I mean, I look at, you know, the Beatitudes when it says, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. I've heard that verse that you mentioned, you know, Jesus came and he brought a sword. Whatever that verse means, it is not licensed to go whack ears off and go wholesale slaughtering people.
He made that clear, too.
Yeah.
Well, he said the gospel will divide, and it does divide. Just don't you be part of that. Let the gospel do it. Not you, not your attitude, not the way you treat people. I love, and I'll get in trouble for quoting her, because I've enjoyed reading some of Anne Lamott's stuff, but Anne's a younger sister in this journey who doesn't get all the political niceties Christians want her to have. So I always get in trouble when I quote her, but I love this statement that she made. She said, you'll know you've made God in your own image when it turns out he hates all the same people you do.
Wow.
Man.
Wow. There's a little ring of truth there.
Oh, gosh. It's like a big gong of truth. First time I read that, because I grew up in this whole conservative culture, religious culture that was take America back for God. I mean, I remember my family being against the civil rights movement because communists had infected it all. And all the ways that we really loved people who were like us. and treated everybody, I wouldn't even say with just suspicion, I would say animosity, who didn't. And that is such a predominant view of the conservative evangelical politic today. And if we're going to be redemptive in whatever culture we live in, we've got to be voices for peace. We've got to be voices for respect and mutual respect of each other's lives, even if we do disagree on major items of philosophy and theology.
So is the truth unimportant?
Are you kidding? My goodness, the truth is absolutely important, but unless it's conveyed in love. And unless we take an interest in the people who we're near, why would we even care about what version of truth we hold to?
See, I think what you just said there is so important. It's like, I think it ceases to be truth when our life that is trying to fight for it argues against it. I think the world ends up hearing and going like, I cannot hear what you're saying because of what you're doing or how you're saying it. I think for it to really be truth that's effectual and gets heard, it's got to be matched with a life that is bearing that out.
Yeah, love is definitely the modality in which truth is shared. I like the idea of it ceases to be truth when it doesn't come from love. You might be making the right arguments, but
it's not coming from the right source.
It's empty and not going to be helpful. God, make us all people who can be voices for peace in a world that's torn apart today by all kinds of conflict.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your questions or feedback at our blog at thegodjourney.com. Or you can call 24 hours a day to our comment line at 805-626-4212.